Welcome to FIC Focus, where Bloomberg Intelligence fixed income, credit currency, and commodities strategists and analysts discuss their short and long-term views on debt markets and issuers. Now, here's the Bloomberg Intelligence FIC research team.
Good tidings there, listeners, and welcome to the April 4th, 2024 edition of State of Distressed Debt, part of the FIC Focus podcast series, where we focus on the U.S. stressed, distressed, and bankruptcy markets. I'm your host, Noel Hebert, and joining me to explore the state of play, as ever, litigation analyst Nagisa Baluku and senior distressed analyst Phil Brendel, each of Bloomberg Intelligence. In addition, Nagisa had the opportunity to sit down with Kenneth Feinberg. Perhaps you know the name. Ken is one of the nation's leading experts in alternative dispute resolution and served as special master of the U.S. government's September 11th Victim Compensation Fund. The government's appointed administrator of the BP Deepwater Horizon Disaster Victim Compensation Fund, amongst other appointments. So really great conversation there. Definitely stay tuned for that. But before we dive in, a request. We here at FIC Focus are working to continue bringing you quality content, exceptional guests. Of course, we can't do that without you. So if you haven't done so already, please do follow, rate, and share. It's free to you, incredibly beneficial to us. So why not? So thank you. And I guess maybe on to the podcast. And Phil, we like to start with you, so let's do that. I don't know what else to say other than so much for seasonals, right? I mean, high yield powered ahead in March, spread broke down to multi-year tights, and then you had the additional kind of tailwind from rates, and you got first quarter performance that was maybe, you know, 1.5% plus or minus a little bit. You know, things are rich, technicals are pretty favorable. You know, everything kind of looks and feels maybe a little bit overextended, but then we're moving into April, which historically one of the better months for the asset class. Is that a kind of a narrative that's replicated in your markets?
It absolutely is, Noel. And thanks for this opportunity. Actually, what was interesting is distressed debt actually underperformed in March like it, you know, usually is a little bit of a road bump. But that was only because over half of its the distressed debt in the ICE distressed bond index is
Altice.
Part of the communications. It's communications debt. And so, you know, you saw what's been going on in that market, and we have a distress ratio in that sector over 20%. That's on its highest levels. But the rest of the space, we're seeing very low distress. And so the blended, it came in at 6% at the end of March. That is lower. That is a 22-month low, and you know, we're getting near the lows of May 2022 when it was actually rising, and it made its high for the cycle of 10.7% a month later. So when it goes, it goes. But I agree with you. It's just been, you know, a deluge of risk on that we've been seeing, and you know, the risk on pockets are saturated. You know, I'm sure you're seeing it in credit spreads, the equity markets. The high concentration is usually, you know, emblematic of a not a healthy market. And then we got geopolitical tinderboxes everywhere one looks, but and a dysfunctional government. But you know, hey, the equity markets don't seem to care.
Yeah, no. So. I mean, I think in high yield, one of the interesting things that we just looked at was the share of the broader high yield index, and that includes anything that's obviously rated and within your space as well, over half. So 51% of the total index trades below 200 basis points. And
that's wild.
You know, it's like you have to kind of sit there for a moment and let that sink in, eclipsed only by, you know, sort of a 1 month pre-financial crisis. And you know, and otherwise it would be an all-time high. So it's kind of insane because the market, as you kind of allude to, kind of remains very bifurcated. I mean, but the interesting thing is, we are still getting, you know, situations. We're still getting bankruptcies or distressed exchanges, and we're going to get into one later in the call. But, you know, I guess, how do you think about it? I mean, is it just a function of we've just got this group of folks that are sort of locked down and they're stuck at distressed, but everybody else is running up? Or do you look for them to get company over, I don't know, the next 6 months?
I've been here before, where the levels and the market keeps screaming, and you just sort of put on your you know that valuation doesn't necessarily make sense, or pricing doesn't match valuation. And I think we're in one of those environments. And, you know, that's where you start looking at charts, you start looking at technicals. And as you pointed out, the seasonals for April are ridiculous. I mean, you know, I think I just published 17 of the past 18 years. April's been a positive month for distressed, and I'm pretty sure it's similar for high yield. And so, you know, look, we're probably going to have one more month of risk on infatuation as new money comes in for the quarter. But, you know, the summer, this is when we start hitting into the tough months. So I say bottom line, credit looks extremely vulnerable for the summer. And, you know, reducing exposure towards the end of April has been smart in the past. I wouldn't be surprised if it proves wise in 2024 as well.
So maybe there's a time when we might need the disaster relief or the victim compensation funding credit skills of a Ken Feinberg, but those days are not today. That said, people do need that skill. So Nagisa, let's go ahead and turn the conversation over to you and your conversation with Kenneth Feinberg.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this April edition of State of Distressed Debt podcast. We're very honored to have with us Kenneth Feinberg. Mr. Feinberg is one of the nation's leading experts in alternative dispute resolution. He has administered numerous high-profile compensation programs, including serving as Special Master of the September 11th Victim Compensation Fund and the administrator of the Gulf Coast Claims Facility that compensated the victims of the BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico, among many other high-profile complex disputes. In the Chapter 11 context, Mr. Feinberg has been the court-appointed mediator in Purdue, Mellenkrod, Emirates Talc and Cypress Mines bankruptcy cases, and the Ong's asbestos bankruptcy case. He was also the court-appointed estimation expert in the first Chapter 11 case of Johnson & Johnson's LTL management. Mr. Feinberg, thank you for being with us today.
Honored. Pleased to be here.
So, nearly all, if not all, of the recent high-profile Chapter 11 cases involving mass tort litigation have relied on mediators to help determine settlement amounts, who's entitled to recovery, how those recoveries are to be apportioned, and ultimately how these types of settlements will be incorporated in a plan of reorganization. So I just mentioned you've helped administer some of the most complex public crises in American history, starting with Agent Orange, BP Deepwater Horizon oil spill, the Boston Marathon, the 9/11 Special Victims Fund. How did you find yourself in this land of bankruptcy mediation? And what lessons carried over from these past experiences outside of bankruptcy continue to inform your work in the Chapter 11 context?
Chapter 11 has become the latest venue for trying to resolve mass claims. The Supreme Court has discouraged the use of the class action in resolving mass claims. In a mass tort, you cannot try these cases in court one at a time. Aggregation is essential. Total peace is the goal. And it seems that bankruptcy has become the default venue for these types of cases. The Supreme Court has a case now, Purdue, that I mediated with co-mediator Lane Phillips, under advisement right now. And what you learn is it doesn't really, in a sense, it doesn't matter what the venue is, class action, an MDL in the federal courts, local aggregation. Bankruptcy is the latest example of creative lawyers trying to consolidate these huge cases in one forum now and in the future.
I think it's fair to say that the bankruptcy code is in a way designed to have people negotiate. I think there's uncertainty that's already built into the code. It often leads to settlement, and that's, I'm not even just talking in the mass tort context. There's this idea that there's not necessarily a one-size-fits-all solution. Do you think that, I know you mentioned that there's not necessarily a difference among the different forms, but do you think that the U.S. bankruptcy system provides some support for mediation?
Oh, certainly. Certainly it provides some support. A very distinguished bankruptcy judge, Michael Kaplan in New Jersey, has publicly expressed the view to the Rules Committee that mediation in bankruptcy is something that ought to be officially permitted in an effort to deal with this recent phenomenon of mass claims coming into the bankruptcy court as the new venue, the new forum.
It has been routine, as you mentioned, but I also imagine that there may be ways in which bankruptcy mediation could differ from that outside of bankruptcy. I'd imagine just the sheer number of stakeholders in Chapter 11 cases can complicate the matters. It can make it expensive to begin with, but I also think it could be particularly more complex if there's a complex capital structure, differences of creditors, of course, each represented by their own counsel, sometimes financial advisor. Is that true? Does that sort of number of creditors and interests complicate the process sometimes?
Certainly complicates the process. The other rather interesting aspect of bankruptcy as a forum for resolving the debtor's mass claims is estimation. In bankruptcy, estimation is hand in glove with the whole bankruptcy process. And what you find is a vigorous debate in bankruptcy when mass claims are involved. Not only what does the debtor confront as to the current volume of claims, but if total peace for the debtor is the goal, how do you estimate over the next 10, 20, 30, 40 years, how many claims in the future must be dealt with today in order to come up with a viable plan? And that is a very important part of the whole bankruptcy process.
So let's stay there. I was going to ask this later, but since we're here, so you were appointed as LTL Management's estimation expert by Judge Kaplan that you mentioned. Your task was to prepare a report on the value and volume of current and future claims that you mentioned. This was claims alleging talc powder caused ovarian cancer or mesothelioma. I know that report, I don't think it ever got published, but what can you tell us about the role? It's not clearly not a mediator, but it's still a neutral and different. Whatever you can tell us about that role, how different it is from being a mediator, what it entails.
To get me involved and to try and help the parties by estimating the number of viable current and future talc claims existed. It's not that the report was never made public. The report was never completed because, as you know, as we were nearing the end of that initiative, where I was in neutral, estimating on behalf of the court, not on behalf of the creditors or the debtors, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals stopped that effort in its tracks, the whole plan. And so, very frustrating that I wasn't able to complete Judge Kaplan's report.
Sure.
But it was a very innovative use of court power, but he had already appointed mediators, but he asked me to estimate. And it was a very interesting, creative, largely unprecedented view of how the court wanted to take advantage of a neutral estimation process.
What was interesting about, I mean, there's so many interesting about LTL Management as a case, but I think some of the issues you've had to mediate in the past, like the 9/11 fund, I believe there was no maximum limit. And I assume that does in a way make your job easier. It was somewhat similar in LTL, not that there was no maximum limit, but at least in that initial bankruptcy, the limit was so high, it was a floor of $64 billion that made it, in a way, not having a maximum limit. Were there parallels on that? Did that make your job easier in a sense?
I guess if you don't have a finite amount or the amount is so high, we never came to grips ultimately with the bottom line because, as I say, the Third Circuit intervened. But, I mean, the real issue, the public policy issue, is very simple to articulate, but not so easy to resolve. The public policy issue is the bankruptcy court the appropriate forum for resolving these mass civil torts? And, you know, you ought to ask the U.S. trustee, who has a view of this as well, as to whether or not under the federal law, the federal statute creating the bankruptcy law, whether or not that Congress anticipated that bankruptcy would be the appropriate venue for resolving this civil crisis involving mass claims like talc, like asbestos, like opioids. And, you know, the scope of that power and the definition of that venue is now sitting with the Supreme Court. And we will likely get a ruling in the Purdue case in the next couple of months as to exactly the confines or the definition of how much bankruptcy can be used to try and aggregate claims and come up with a plan to resolve current and future claims. Big public policy issue.
Yeah, and I mean, and obviously the U.S. trustee seems to have a pretty strong view in the Purdue case. So let's kind of stay on that topic. So in bankruptcy, I think it's fair to say that we think of the debtor in possession as being the leader of the case. But in your role as a mediator, do you find yourself having to make other parties involved comfortable with the mediation process? Do you consider it part of your job to show that mediation can be empowering and not a weakness, for example? I think your typical practice involves voluntary mediation, but there are times, not uncommon, where parties may be resistant to mediation, especially in bankruptcy. Do you find yourself sort of helping change that perspective? And there are also plenty of due process concerns in bankruptcy as well, right? The tort claimants are losing their right to jury trial after all. Does it complicate your work as a mediator?
Oh, it does complicate. It does complicate. Because when you're mediating in bankruptcy, your goal is not only to reach a plan resolution among the participants, but you want to minimize the likelihood of creditor objections. And you're looking over your shoulder. It's not enough to get a resolution or achieve resolution through mediation among the bankruptcy participants. You also hope that the plan that evolves will minimize objections and maximize plan vote consent so that the plan can be implemented. And you're absolutely right that mediation in bankruptcy really has interested parties well beyond the plan proponents, the plaintiffs representing tort claimants and the creditor, the debtor. There are a great many other interested parties, creditors, insurance companies, observing the process and hoping that the plan will be acceptable.
And I assume that the fact that parties don't necessarily align in this very clear party A versus party B complicates the matter. I think it's not uncommon for parties to be aligned on certain aspects of the dispute, for example, how you value an asset, but then they could disagree on other aspects, how those assets are then distributed. And I think you mentioned earlier in Purdue you had a co-mediator. That's not uncommon in bankruptcy too. How does that fit into your role? How do you work through that?
I think it is rather in bankruptcy. Now, in J&J, there were two or three mediators.
Right.
Purdue was a unique situation. I benefited tremendously from Lane Phillips being my co-mediator. We were basically in sync both of us in trying to advance the Purdue a resolution. And then a third mediator, after we departed, former bankruptcy judge Chapman came in and helped close the deal. So sometimes in mediation, two or three heads are better than one. And I give tremendous credit to my co-mediators. And the advantage of co-mediators, two or three mediators, sometimes the debtor or the creditor plaintiffs or outside would-be objectors, they trust a certain mediator. They've worked with a mediator. They don't distrust other mediators. They just have a sort of experience dealing with Judge Chapman or Lane Phillips. And it helps if everybody just sets the sight on the same goal, which is however we get there, whatever mechanisms we use, whatever techniques, can we achieve closure? Can we get the parties to yes? And in Purdue, for example, except for the U.S. trustee, we did. The U.S. trustee is formidable, though, and ultimately the U.S. trustee objected.
So on that, I was going to ask you later what makes a good mediator, but perhaps more important on this topic is, I'm curious if you think if there's ever a right mediator for a specific case or a specific issue. Are there, for example, are there certain kinds of mediation that you yourself do not take?
Well, don't ask me to mediate a divorce case or a family squabble, because in cases like that, I've found over 50 years of work that those cases get so emotional. The parties get so caught up in the emotion of the moment, it's very difficult for a mediator to offer reasonable solutions when the parties aren't really acting very unreasonably. But in most cases, especially high visibility commercial, patent, copyright, contract disputes, I don't think that a mediator with a special expertise is as important as a mediator who knows how to mediate. You can always educate a mediator, always can educate a mediator on the merits of the case as each party sees it. I think much more important than expertise in mediation is the skill of the mediator, the personality of the mediator, the experience of the mediator. In fact, you can make an argument that you don't want a mediator with expertise because a mediator may come with his own or her own views of the case, of the patent law, of the law of copyright or whatever it might be. You'd rather have a mediator who's experienced, effective. Each side will educate the mediator on the merits of the case. So I look to the quality and experience of the mediator rather than the substantive expertise surrounding the dispute.
You mentioned Judge Chapman, and it's not uncommon now, perhaps more than ever in bankruptcy cases, for a sitting judge or retired judge to be appointed as a mediator. I wonder if you have a view on that. There are certain lawyers and people out there that do say that has sometimes has its drawbacks. Do you think that there are instances where having a judge appointed as a mediator could be useful to the process?
Useful. Look at Judge Chapman. She's terrific. She comes with a certain skill, experience, background. Welcome. I mean, I don't ever draw, general conclusions about judges or lawyers as media. Who's the person? Who instills the confidence among the parties? Who has the confidence of the judge? Very important. And I look to the individual rather than any generic rules governing he's good, she's good, that type of person should be a mediator. If there's no conflict and the parties welcome the role of the former judge, I think that's wonderful. Judge Drain in the Purdue case, I think Judge Drain would be a very, very effective mediator. And not just in bankruptcy. I think Judge Chapman, Judge Drain, Lane Phillips, a former federal judge, Eric Green in Boston, a professor, former academic. Terrific mediators, just terrific. So there's room for good people in any of these mediations.
Understood. Another important part of mediation, I assume, is making sure that the right parties are in the room.
Very important. The people at the mediation table, the right parties with authority to get the deal done. If you don't have the right parties at the table, you're wasting time, and the other side develops some mistrust. If one side feels that the right people aren't in the room to help resolve the dispute, mediation won't succeed.
So that brings me to sort of the different topic, which is logistics in mediation. I'm curious, I'd love if you could take us sort of inside a session. I'm sure there's not a typical one, but if you could just kind of understand what happens sort of behind closed doors, how important are joint sessions? Do parties typically, do you prefer them having meet in one room? I assume we prefer in person, but there's also the Zoom option. How does that change the dynamic? I'm curious specifically about committee members. And in bankruptcy mediation, there's obviously plenty of committee representatives, but how often do you get the members themselves involved?
Oh, you get the members involved. Now, during the COVID crisis, during the pandemic, Zoom became the rule. And Zoom worked okay. I found Zoom worked better than I thought it would. It's no substitute for in-person, face-to-face mediation. Now, normally, in the normal case in bankruptcy, we would contemplate face-to-face meetings periodically. The tort claims committee, representatives of the debtor, sometimes representatives of the insurance industry, face-to-face at a time in the mediation process when the mediator believes we've made enough progress in separate rooms or in separate Zooms or in separate meetings. Now it's time to bring everybody together for a day or two. And let's see if the gap, which was once very wide, has now been narrowed substantially, and now we need face-to-face mediation with the right people with authority to bring this to a conclusion. And it works. It worked in Imre Cyprus. It worked in Purdue. It works in most of Mallinckrodt. It works in most of these large cases where the time comes very, very, it's strategic on the part of the mediators. When it's time to bring people together, we've made enough progress separately, and now let's face-to-face try and close this out.
Do you think mediation sometimes can benefit from limits, say maximum time limit, for example?
Absolutely essential. You mentioned, might it be helpful to have a time limit? I've found in mediation, it is critical that everybody, when they begin to mediate, they know that the mediation will end on a designated time, on a designated day. That's because very often people wait. I saw this in 9/11 and in other major visible disputes. People wait until the very end of the process before they put their cards on the table. And what I've found over the years as a mediator is making sure that at the beginning of the process, there is a termination time. Even in 9/11, Congress said, this 9/11 victim fund, go ahead, Mr. Feinberg, but you have 33 months. That's it. Every claim has to be resolved within 33 months, and on that date, it ends. Well, during the last 6 months of the 9/11 fund, about two-thirds of the claims came into the program voluntarily. Deadlines, very important.
What is there anything specific that you think lawyers, other advisors can do to help the mediation process, make your job easier? I'm not sure that's a possibility. Anything specific you can target?
Well, I like to work with lawyers whose objective is not adversarial, is not bomb throwing in the courtroom, gotcha, but is rather they've been instructed by their clients, let's really try and resolve it. Let's put ourselves in the other person's shoes. What's their concerns? And I find it's very, very useful if lawyers or financial advisors in bankruptcy take the attitude that our objective is not adversarial litigation, one-upsmanship. Let's try and forge consensus. And good mediators help promote that. And what you find in mediation, parties may initiate mediation very, very skeptical, very unwilling to think that yes is possible. The more they get involved and have a stake in the process, human nature being what it is, more and more parties are likely to commit to getting this done. We've taken this time, we've become heavily involved in this process. Let's make it work. That's tremendously helpful.
And how do you prepare? Is there anything specific you do to prepare? And I don't know if it's different based on the case or depending on the issue involved. Is there anything sort of you do at the beginning of mediation that helps kind of set the path forward?
There's substantive and procedural preparation. Procedurally, are the right people in the room? Is the mediator satisfied we've got the right group of debtors, creditors, interested observers? We've got the right people to get this done. We're not missing a key individual or a key interested party. Substantively, I've learned over the years there's no substitute for knowing the case even better than the participant. So I will immerse myself in the details of the case, in the arguments of each side. I've asked their assistants. They'll provide me public documents, private documents, the bankruptcy submission, the opposition, etc. Study it so that you look for opportunities, Achilles heels of each side, to try and, through force of argument and personality, bring people closer together. And if you've got the credibility that each side acknowledges, well, we may not agree with the mediator on this, and we may not agree, but Feinberg has credibility, or Lane Phillips, or Eric Green, or whoever, or Judge Chapman, they have credibility. And that credibility, when you try and impress upon the parties, have you thought about this? And the risk of uncertainty. Right now, you control your own destiny, certainty, but you roll the dice and courts and juries take over. Those are some of the keys to prepare yourself.
I want to be mindful of your time, and I sort of want to kind of look forward a little bit. How do you pick and choose what you do from sort of now on? What cases and opportunities are you sort of most looking forward to taking moving forward?
Look, I've been doing this for half a century, back to Agent Orange with Judge Weinstein in federal court in Brooklyn. First of all, these cases don't come up that often. Don't think that people are knocking down my door to mediate. I mean, there are certain cases. You look for cases where challenging. If a court asks you, you're going to say yes. You don't say, no, I'm too busy to a court. Or to a president or an attorney general.
That's right.
Or Congress. But, you know, you enjoy the parties. Usually in my situation, some of the lawyers who I've dined with, had drinks with, and worked with over the years, if they knock on your door and they ask you, will you help, it's pretty hard to say no. I'm in a situation like a few mediators where I pick and choose. I don't have to wait. But especially if there's a patriotic 9/11 or the Boston Marathon bombings, or President Obama asked me, BP oil spill, the Deepwater Horizon, you know, you can't say you're too busy in those cases.
I want to end with one last, it's not really a question. I was recently listening to Judge Sanchi, retired judge from Bankruptcy Court District of Delaware, talk about mediation generally in the bankruptcy context. He has a quote that I want to get your reaction on to sort of end this. He said, a bad settlement is better than a great judgment. Do you have a reaction to that? Does that speak to you?
I've lived my whole professional career believing that statement. First of all, you don't know what a bad settlement is when it is it occurs well before a good judgment or a bad judgment. I would agree with the judge and add that a mediated settlement agreed to by all parties, you know, it's voluntary, the mediation process, you can't force anybody, unlike arbitration. Unlike arbitration, you can't force people to accept a mediated settlement, proposed settlement. I would say a mediation resulting in a settlement voluntarily entered into by the parties is vastly preferable than going down that whole road of litigation, resulting in a judgment where you roll the dice with judge and jury. And that's why I think mediation has a role to play in almost all disputes here in the United States. I agree with the judge.
I think that's a great place to end it. Thank you so much, Mr. Feinberg. This was really informative. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back, listeners. We now turn to that part of our program where Nagisa and Phil dig into the particulars of given distressed and bankruptcy situations. Nagisa, we always like to start with you because you always have so much to talk about. Maybe let's start with Yellow. We got a March ruling over withdrawal liabilities claims. Is that a win, lose, or draw for the company and its equity holders?
Thanks, Neil. So it's definitely a win for the company of equity holders. We just sort of need to be cautious about how much weight we put into it. So the Delaware Bankruptcy Court, as I said, in March decided to actually keep control over this resolution of the now $7.8 billion dispute over withdrawal liability claims. It is a win for Yellow. It is a win for MFN, its largest shareholder. It's basically we have the bankruptcy court preserving its core functions. Yellow and MFN had fought hard to keep the dispute in bankruptcy as opposed to sending it to arbitrators. Yet, as I said, we do need to be careful about how much weight we put into it. The ultimate decision on this claims allowance issue will most likely be reviewed by district court. It will follow the same path that arbitration would have. So this will certainly not be the last. Whenever the bankruptcy court decides it, which will be likely later this year, in the second half of this year, it will not likely be the last word on the issue. This wasn't this decision, by the way. There's a certain Third Circuit case law which could be read, and court agreed with this, court said it could be read for the general proposition that claims allowance issues where the underlying claim is subject to mandatory arbitration continue, remain subject to arbitration in bankruptcy. Still, it was this idea that both the decision, its own decision, the bankruptcy court decision, and the arbitrator's determination would undergo a very similar appeal process that played a role in this, in keeping this decision in the bankruptcy court. What distinguished this case from a sort of typical party A versus party B issue, where it most likely would have been sent to mediation, to arbitration rather, sorry, it was the involvement of MFN. MFN stands to gain the most from this dispute, but the fact that MFN has exercised its right in the case, has subjected to this claim, made the court feel that it wasn't confident enough that arbitrators would permit MFN to participate in arbitration, and therefore they may not have played a role, the role that they needed to play in the bankruptcy process. I think there's obviously a threat of delay here. You're talking about arbitration. The trial on this issue is scheduled to commence in August. The court didn't count that arbitration would be proceeding on a similar timeline. There's also concerns expressed by Yellow as to, well, how many arbitrators would that be? Would they be able to do? Would they challenge arbitrators? So there were sort of drawbacks to that path and from a timing perspective as well that played a role into this. into the decision. I think what's also interesting here is PBGC's involvement. They will probably end up playing a role in dispute, but so far they've put forward plenty of efforts to sort of curb the bankruptcy court's rights to evaluate the validity of its own of PBGC's regulations. But the bankruptcy court has made it clear that while it will not restrict PBGC and other interested parties from being involved in this, it has been reluctant, to say the least, to accept PBGC's assertion that their regulations with respect to this issue need to be challenged pursuant to the Administrative Procedure Act and away from the bankruptcy court. So the bankruptcy court doesn't seem to agree with it for now. This is really what we're looking at. This is the biggest dispute in this case. Its resolution will really tell us whether the entire equity will be wiped out, whether there will be what's going to happen for general unsecured claims, whether there will be a substantial return to shareholders. So it's going to make the difference in this case. I don't think it's the kind of dispute that lends itself to mediation or settlement. So I think it'll be interesting to see how it will progress. And we're looking at that August date, though, that may get extended.
All right. So kind of sit in your hands and wait for a little bit on that one. Maybe turning over to the book of Genesis and their chapter 11 plan. I guess a few items here to consider. I mean, you've got obviously the resurging crypto market, Bitcoin certainly after the ETFs got approved, but you also have the specter of the FTX bankruptcy relative to the company's goals around sort of in-kind distribution. So I guess what's the latest on Genesis and how are you thinking about the outcomes there?
So all of what you said is involved here, actually. So this is Genesis concluded its confirmation hearing in March. And the main dispute, as far as confirmation goes, for the entire case goes for the matter, is around the proposed payout to customers. That payout stands to be around 77% of crypto assets in kind, and that's important, which is something that DCG, so the parent, was not bankrupt, is objecting to. This turned out to be a very interesting issue. At the core of this is the question of when you determine a bankruptcy claim. And in many ways, the answer is simple. We know the claim is typically determined in US dollars as of the petition date. And that's exactly what DCG is asking for here. And if that's the case, Genesis customers wouldn't benefit from the rise in Bitcoin price. This happened since Genesis filed, which was January of last year. So that's what it's about. Bitcoin prices have gone up since then. Customers do want to take advantage of that increase. And DCG, as the parent, as non-bankrupt parent, says, well, wait a second here. You shouldn't be benefiting from the rise in prices. So let's set your claim to the dollar value that it was as of the petition date. I don't think that's necessary here. I don't actually think it's necessary to value the crypto claims as of the petition date. We do have Section 502B of the Bankruptcy Code, which does state that in the case of a claim objection, that claim amount is determined in U.S. dollars as of the petition date. And there's no question that bankruptcy courts typically abide by that language. But it's Genesis' intention here to pay these customers in kind that likely provides sufficient support for taking into account this pricing changes since the petition date. In many ways, what Genesis is trying to do looks a lot like reinstatement. If Genesis actually had sufficient digital assets to make customers whole, which it doesn't, it could have pursued a reinstatement, and DCG likely wouldn't have been able to object in that case. So restatement being a well-established debtor right, basically being restoration of debt under its original terms. So the fact that Genesis isn't fully restating these claims doesn't necessarily grant DCG the ability to object. That's what Genesis is saying, and I think that's probably right. Genesis is referring to this as restatement light or quasi-restatement, and basically maintaining that this Section 502B of the Bankruptcy Code doesn't serve as a cap on creditor recoveries. It just sort of gives the general the general language for valuing a claim in case of objections. I think, though, as a threshold matter, there's also a standing issue here. I think the CG may actually lack standing to prohibit customers from benefiting from the rise in Bitcoin prices because there's a $32 billion in government claims that stands ahead of equity. So it stands ahead of the CG claim. So that's probably the biggest hurdle for the CG here. But we do have FTX, or you mentioned FTX. So I think though DCG's plan to pay its customers in kind sets it apart from other crypto cases, we can't ignore the fact that a ruling in favor of Genesis by the New York Bankruptcy Court, which is where Genesis is, risks conflicting with a decision that was reached at the end of January of this year in the Delaware Bankruptcy Court in the FTX bankruptcy proceedings. There, Judge Dorsey noted that despite some objection to FTX's selection of the petition date as the date for determining the value of digital assets, basically Section 502B was clear that that's how the claims need to be determined. They need to be determined in U.S. dollars as the petition date. So in ways, I think his hands were tied, and I think he uses those exact words in the transcript. I think this, again, this objective to pay customers in kind is probably sufficient to back and overcome the constraints of the bankruptcy code under 502B. But I think it's always interesting when you have a potential conflict, no matter how slight, between New York and Delaware bankruptcy courts and how they treat this issue.
Do you think that it looks like the debtors are going to basically have this power rest with them. Like going forward, the debtors will be making this decision. You know, here they see that the government has these massive claims and they're just like, well, let's get it out to the customers. And perhaps that makes our settlement position with the government on their subordinated claims easier. I'm just curious, if things kind of go the way the debtors have been wanting here, is that it seems like a powerful vehicle for the debtors, at least with crypto.
I think that's right. And not just that, I think what Genesis has said is that the right for this to stay with the debtor is actually incorporated into the code, because they say that 502B comes into play only the case when you're responding to a creditor, to an objection. If this is their own proposal and they're not responding to an objection, then it doesn't come into play in it at all. You can't, it just doesn't come into play. So they say that just by definition, 502B comes in the face of an objection, and absent that, it's totally up to the debtor, and it doesn't serve as a cap. And as far as timeline, no, there is typically no timeline. It's a ruling on a confirmation decision. It's probably sooner rather than later. Courts typically do not take a long
highly
time.
Highly specific. I'll take that. Yeah, I love the sooner rather than later. But Phil, maybe let's pivot to you here and bring you back into the conversation. Rackspace. Interesting name. We just got, it is early April, so we just got the distressed exchange there and a selected default downgrade from S&P. I guess, what's the story there? What kind of intrigues you? What are you thinking?
It's a fascinating case because their numbers have been horrific. The revenue's been declining. You know, maybe we've seen some serial, quarter to quarter improvement lately, but generally speaking, really bad numbers. The private cloud business has been shrinking, and public cloud as well. But what I find the most interesting here is Apollo maintains a 59% ownership stake, even though it's a public company. And all of the bonds are trading at, incredibly distressed prices. You know, like I think the unsecured notes have probably averaged a 30 handle over the past year. And even the first lien debt, term loan and bonds have been trading significantly distressed. And all during this downturn, Rackspace has been purchasing back its bonds. It's been raising secured debt through an accounts receivable facility. And actually in 2023, it bought back $444 million of debt, most of it unsecured, at an average price of 38 cents on the dollar. And then in the beginning of this year, they now went out with an exchange offer And this is what you're seeing with a lot of these distressed exchange offers these days, is they get a group that holds over 50%, you know, ideally maybe even 2/3 of the group. But actually, in a lot of respects, they just want to get over the majority so that they can get favored economics. And then they did a private exchange, you know, for their term loans and for the, and what they do is they provide new money, a first lien, first out on, you know, they play game, you know, they create a separate loan. They put new assets into a box that is going to support that. And then they have a first lien, second out, and they rolled their debt at, I would estimate, it wasn't fully disclosed because it's a private exchange, but about 80 cents on the dollar. Anyway, they get that done, and then they go out with a public exchange, and that is only offering 70 cents on the dollar. So you see, you know, 10 to 15 cents is typical for what you see for private versus public. We saw this in GoTo Group as well. And I mean, it's pretty incredible if you think about it, because they basically, except for a stub piece of loans and notes, the early tender got about 90% of the notes. And I think the first lien term loan is closer to 97%. Oh. But there's about 100 million of first lien debt out there. These were people with first liens on you know, on the assets, and the fear, the presence, you know, I'd say of, you know, Apollo's reputation, surely, but of the potential things that you could do with the covenants, the way they were written, these folks took, you know, especially on the public exchange side, a 30-cent haircut on their first lien debt without any kind of bankruptcy. So. Anyway, net, this is an interesting story too. You know, Rackspace is, they're focused on the AI opportunity. And, you know, to the extent that, you know.
Isn't everybody nowadays, right?
I mean, yeah.
It's kind of, you got to put
hurt.
You got to put it in the name.
I understand it doesn't hurt. But, you know, there's a lot of significant technology know-how in this business. And, they are already seeing their backlog improve, and they anticipate that really is going to show up in their numbers probably the second half of the year. So, you know, look, I think between the bond buybacks in 2023 and now this exchange, which it's going to close, you know, you're talking about, you know, maybe reducing your debt by about $1 billion. And that's, you know, what a great opportunistic, you know, for the shareholders. You know, they captured, you know, discounts like crazy. And, you know, if this thing, if they do catch that AI tailwind and their numbers, they expect it'll take about 2 years for the financial turnaround to take hold. And in the meantime, all of this exchanges, there's a complete big debt wall in 2028. And so the stubs will be February of 2028, and just behind that is the is all of this new roll debt. And I think what you'll see is 2028. We'll see if it hits the road, but
probably 2027. But I think they should just change their name to Rackspace, but spell space SPAICE. Call it a day. See what happens.
Oh, wow. Who says investing is your thing? No, maybe it's marketing.
Yeah, I'm there. So speaking, well, I guess this doesn't really have anything to do with marketing, but I am transitioning away to the next topic, which is goal. I was going to try to weave in something on marketing, but then it just fell apart right before my eyes. But so Nagisa, bring
you
back.
You couldn't spell goal with AI. Is that the problem?
I mean, we could try, but... you know, so I think our equity colleagues are out and talking about some of the increased profit outlook that we've got for them over there. I guess what's going on in the bankruptcy itself? How is that progressing? I think we got the big loan. Anything new there?
Yeah, so Goal hasn't been in bankruptcy for that long. What has been doing so far has been negotiating aircraft lease modification agreements with lessors, which was expected and very much welcomed by all parties. But what I wanted to address today was sort of the interesting issue that's come out of it is the committee's objection that was filed late April 3rd. The committee does not oppose the economic substance of these lease modifications, but targets certain lockup provisions and raises alarms, so to speak, about the threat that they may pose to unsecured creditors. So what are lockup provisions? What GOL has basically done is include provisions in this agreement that obligate this aircraft lessors to vote in favor. The committee says effectively any Chapter 11 plan that incorporates these business terms, as long as the debtors meets a minimum liquidity level and projected leverage ratios, so kind of two financial conditions. The issue here is that this would be votes for a non-existent Chapter 11 plan before disclosure statement has been proposed or approved. And I think that because of it, it probably does raise 1125B issues, 1125B being a section of the bankruptcy code. Again, there's no approved disclosure statement here. There's not a plan term sheet. There's not even a business plan, the committee says. So when these lockup provisions are uncommon, when they're approved, they typically come in the context of sort of true plan support agreements where creditors are agreeing to support certain key terms of a Chapter 11 plan, but they're not, this is not the way they're coming in here. So what's the risk of this? If these are permitted effectively, GOL would have what the committee calls a super exclusive right to propose a plan. The committee says that GOL would have this super exclusive right to propose a plan. To be clear, GOL already has the exclusive right to propose a plan, but what they would be doing is effectively control the votes, in this case, of an impaired accepting class, potentially. So what the concern is that you'd be incentivizing debtors to get creditors to agree to stipulations ahead of time, stipulations that provide them with some sort of go-forward business opportunities. And at the same time, you'd be stripping away their right to vote on the plan. But there's also concern as to how this affects other creditors, in this case, other unsecured creditors, that basically by locking in these votes, you'd be disenfranchising all the other secured creditors by just kind of locking in key votes, certain threshold or votes for the plan. The concern is also that, I mean, the impact goes beyond GOL. By allowing this, you'd be permitting any debtor to kind of seize control of the case way ahead of time by locking in votes before clients even proposed. That typically raises concerns for the bankruptcy court. So there's a hearing on this coming up on April 10th. So that's kind of the interesting legal issue in GOL right now. Otherwise, it's sort of quiet as far as the bankruptcy goes.
All right. So something we'll have to follow up on next month, or obviously for terminal subscribers, you'll probably be able to see Nagisa's research on the interim on that topic. But maybe staying with something that revolves around leases, moving from aircraft leases to commercial real estate. A short update I think you have on WeWork. I think they continue to question the payment obligations on the post-petition rent stuff. How viable is that? What's going on there?
So it wouldn't have been viable, I think, if it actually made its way to bankruptcy court, but it hasn't, and it most likely won't, especially since WeWork on April 2nd announced that it had agreements to amend. Now it's sort of to amend 150 leases, reject 150 others, and then also assume 150 more. So that all would amount to an $8 billion in future rent reductions. This is pretty significant because progress has been limited as far as the bankruptcy court, what we've heard in bankruptcy. WeWork announced in early March, so just under a month ago, that had sought to reject just 93 leases and amend 13. And that included, I believe, the 70 leases it sought to reject on day one of the case. So it's pretty substantial progress from early March to early April. I think that this progress has been at least in part based on its kind of this pretty, this efforts to, or attempts to refuse, or just plain refuse of the pay post-petition rent for certain leases, which again, I don't think would have been, it would have succeeded if that reached the bankruptcy court, but it seems to have provided some support for negotiations.
And I guess maybe a big finish here, Rite Aid.
Not sure how big it is, but it's finally.
That's why it was set in chest. Bankruptcy. Come on.
I think it stayed in bankruptcy for about 5-6 more months than it was supposed to, but it intended to. So it's going to come out likely early May. There's a confirmation hearing towards the end of April. There's still an agreement to hand 90% of the company to the senior secured note holders. Who members of an ad hoc group of secured bondholders are providing an additional $57 million of new money. And the two committees who were slated to get zero under the previous plan are getting some money. I think they're getting $20 million in cash right at confirmation, and then potential to get over $27 million in cash later on. Also some potential litigation rights. So kind of, Rite Aid has been going through mediation for several months now. So this was expected in a way that they would come to an agreement. Otherwise, there wasn't really a viable path forward.
So, and I guess maybe the quick question here, because I haven't followed that one as closely, I'm assuming this is a reorganization then, if that's
we'll,
the case, or
we'll
is this a liquidation?
That. Yeah, there's definitely, yeah, they weren't able to get a buyer for the entire company. They've tried that. So we'll call it a reorganization.
All right.
But no, they do have AI and aid. So
they actually
the
do.
Right aid.
It's already there. They don't even need to change their name. I think, I'm telling you, this is .com. 2.0, right? So I think they'd need to just focus on that aspect of it. If we've got nothing else, we've got AI. Excellent. So with that, Nagisa, Phil, thanks as ever. And of course, thank you once again to our special guest this month, Ken Feinberg. And of course, thank you too, listeners. Always happy to have you here. And until next time, this has been State of Distress Debt.